Welcome to Lightning in a Bottle, a podcast series for owners and key stakeholders in privately held companies and the professionals that surround them. My name is Josh Pottinger, and together with Jason Georgianis, we run ATX Wealth Partners here at UBS. Jason and I have been teamed up now for over 20 years, and each of us has over 25 years of experience in the financial services industry. Our goal is to bring real-world perspectives to help you prepare yourself, your family, and your business for the day that you decide to monetize some or all of your ownership position in the company. Throughout this series, we will provide our own thoughts as well as interview key people along the way. Feel free to email us at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And with that, let's go ahead and get started. We've got episode number 22 of our Lightning in a Bottle podcast, so I'm pretty excited today. We're going to be doing part two. So our team was discussing how to kind of go about talking about tax and financial and operational due diligence. And after convening with all of the experts, we decided to break this up into two different episodes. So the first episode, we primarily focused on the tax and financial side of things. And today we're going to be talking about the operational due diligence that goes into either merging with another company, buying another company, selling into another company, whatever that might be. And so, you know, the purpose of us putting this particular series together is really to help those owners out there uncover some things that they may not even have known about or thought about. And so, you know, we're not trying to answer all of the questions in today's conversation, but we do want to, you know, talk about some relevant issues that people may want to think about. So we've got a big crew today. I've got three guests in front of me. We're sitting around a round table here downtown Austin. Matt Bryce, Managing Director in the Private Equity Services Group, with a focus, well, and specifically on the operations group. Matt, thank you for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Great. I've got Nico Bascunyan, and he is a senior director, private equity services operations group with Alvarez and Marcel.
Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, Nico. And finally, we have Aaron Horton, senior director, private equity services operations group at Alvarez and Marcel.
Hi, Josh. Good to be here.
Good to see all three of you. So we have got a fun crew today, and we're going to be going through a lot of information in a short period of time. So before we get started here, I'd love, rather than hearing me ramble on, I'd love for you guys to do a quick little intro on yourself. So let's start with you, Matt.
Thanks, Josh. Matt Bryce again, based here in Austin, Texas. I've been with A&M for 15 years. As Josh mentioned, I'm part of our operations team focused on private equity services. So I work exclusively for private equity firms and their portfolio companies. We do operational diligence every day. I'm focused on the software and services industry, so I do a lot of work in that space. Mm-hmm. Very nice to meet you.
Okay, great. Thanks, Matt. Aaron?
Aaron Horton, similar to Matt, I'm with our operations group based here out of Austin, Texas. I've been with the firm for 7 years, supporting both operational due diligence as well as post-acquisition merger carve-out execution, both buy-side and sell-side. Prior to joining A&M, I was at a small business that went through the process of being private equity backed. So definitely have some exposure there, helping roll out some of those operational improvements and what it's like to fulfill some of the requests that you see from your investment partners. So have that before coming to A&M, and looking forward to talking about that today.
Good. Well, thank you for joining us.
And just for closing, thank you for having us, Josh. I'm Nico Bascunyan. I'm part of the same group as Matt and Erin. Joined A&M almost 4 years ago. Most of my transactions have been in the intersection between education and technology. What we basically
education
call
education and technology.
Yes. Yep. And prior to A&M, I spent like over a decade doing investment banking in South America.
Okay. Whereabouts?
Santiago, based in Santiago, but basically covering Chile, Peru, and Colombia.
Oh, okay. I love to fly fish, and I'd love to go down to
in the south of Chile. Yes. Yeah. That's a great spot for rivers and catching like nice trouts.
Yes. 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 I was talking to a friend of mine that lives down there in Argentina, and he's doing a really cool event or a deal in down in the Patagonia region. It's like a 10-day deal. You're camping out in the mountains. It sounds amazing. I want to do that. But Maybe I should do podcasting on fly fishing.
You know? I think that's probably, a good
maybe
idea.
I get a bigger, a cast a wider net, get more people.
Obviously, but, some passion there.
Yep. So, okay, well, good. Well, thank you everybody for joining us here. And why don't we kick it off? Let's just talk about the basic topic, like what is operational due diligence and why should people know about it?
Yeah, Josh, I'll start with that. And we're going to kind of add comments from our mm-hmm. individual perspectives. We all do a little bit different types of work. But generally speaking, what a private equity firm is doing when they conduct operational due diligence is they're trying to investigate the quality and maturity of a company's business processes and business from an operational perspective, how the company runs. They're trying to identify risks and red flags. With that, with how the business runs, they're trying to understand the scalability of the business, either to support the growth thesis or to support add-on acquisitions, right, as a platform. Mm-hmm. They're trying to look for value creation opportunities. What are ways we can improve EBITDA? We can help juice growth. If it's a merger, they're obviously looking at merger-related synergies. What do I get when I combine these two businesses together? So those are the main focus areas for operational due diligence. And then there's a few kind of partner diligences that come along with us sometimes. You know, occasionally we'll do IT due diligence, really focused on the systems and how they help the business run. Are they supporting the business adequately? Human capital or HRDD, looking at human capital issues with the business. So there can be deep dives into different functional areas. But it's all about how effectively and efficiently does that business run.
Mm-hmm. Great. Why do investors request operational due diligence?
Well, Josh, the definition of an operational due diligence is very broad. So mm-hmm. let me just explore a few use cases sure. that may help like understanding why investors really require this. Like in the first place, you may, as a buyer talking to the seller, you may want to understand what's the incremental value, right? Can you find in a very competitive bidding process more value for me to basically try to win this transaction, this company, right? So we will come in, as Matt said, and we will spend 3 to 5 weeks and try to understand where do you have potential incremental value, like where 1 + 1 is more than 2, mm-hmm. basically. Another use case is, and this is very interesting for a family-owned company, potentially running a sales setting down the road, is margins are deteriorating. Like post-COVID, this is something we saw like many times post-COVID. I used to have a 25, 30% EBITDA margin, and now I'm down to 15, 20. And I really want to exit the business. I don't have a legacy plan like to run my company. Mm-hmm. Can you help me in the next like 12, 18 months to turn my margins around so I can basically plan 24 months from now like an exit and basically leave my business? That's what we typically call a performance improvement that really belongs to the what we call the ODD, the operational due diligence family of like type of
you're projects. Talking about something that so there's not necessarily a transaction happening at the moment,
not yet.
You're talking about getting them
right and that
ready,
thinking like the seller. Yes. You want to basically maximize your exit value,
right?
So if your margins used to be and you have your financials to back that up, 25-30%, and you're down to 15, help me get back to 25 or closer to 30 so I can maximize my exit. And then the third one, it's basically a very short type of project we call like ODD2. It's like what we call the kicking the tires. If I'm buying something,
yes,
I want to know that I'm basically buying what they told me in a few meetings or in this corporate information memorandum. And we go in like for 2 weeks and it's what we might say like a red flag report. Mm-hmm. We basically check that everything looks the way the seller is mentioning.
So you've got two sides. You've got somebody on the PE side that's looking at acquiring the company, either to pull it up as a platform company or to bolt on to another company, right? And then what Nico was talking about is actually from the seller side, recognizing that they need some, you know, that improve some things around the business in order to maximize that exit. When you're in a private equity transaction, okay, is the seller, do they have their own person typically doing this work to see how they would fit within the company that they're looking to get pulled up into?
Occasionally.
And so you have two separate people. And the reason why I mention this is because in an earlier podcast, we talked to the authors of a book called Exit Right. And one of the things they talked about is from the seller's perspective is understanding their fit. How do they fit within this larger strategic in this example, right? What are the synergies? How are they going to get integrated? And they used an example, like when Facebook bought Instagram for $1 billion, there was like, I don't know, 10 people in a garage somewhere and they paid $1 billion for them. Everybody thought they were nuts, but now, you know, Instagram represents like, you know, $20 billion of the revenue that Facebook generates, yep. Right? It ended up being an amazing thing. So I was just curious because the value that the transaction is struck at is going to be a combination of using the traditional metrics like multiple of EBITDA, multiple of revenue, whatever that might be, but also there's probably some value if that could be extracted through that merger.
Yeah. It's definitely a two-way street, yep. Right? The sellers are trying to understand how they would fit within the buyer's world, right? Mm-hmm. And even, you know, what it might be like to report to them, you know, what are they going to bring of value to help them grow and achieve their goals? And the buyer is looking at the company to say, you know, how does leadership think about running this business? Do they understand the business? Do they manage it well? Right. It's definitely a two-way street. And in more complex transaction types, the seller may also have an advisor in addition to the buyer. So the situations where you normally see that is if a seller is selling part of their business. So say they have a software company and they have two products and they're going to sell one of those products. We call that a carve out, right? And the seller will typically do work to be able to present that product as a standalone business. Mm. So that the buyer can understand what they're getting, what they're not getting, what do they need to add to it. So in that situation, you'll typically see advisors on both sides, one for the seller, mm-hmm. helping them prepare, and one for the buyer. Mm-hmm. The bankers, the investment bankers in a process generally are helping you present the company. They're not helping you make operational decisions like that, like in a split like that, how to split the company. They're just helping you present the company well, helping find potential buyers, managing the process, that kind of stuff. So operational consultants are in there doing that more kind of nuts and bolts work. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. How many people do you see in a typical deal team? You've got your banker, attorney, I guess you got your operational due diligence people, your tax, your financial.
Yeah, you could have HR and IT specialists. You've got the private equity itself. You know, sometimes there's specialized types of diligence around environmental or regulatory issues. So you can see it balloon in complex scenarios. Operational due diligence isn't done on every deal. It doesn't make sense for every deal. If a private equity is buying a business and they're really just intending to run it as is or grow it, you know, they're essentially investing in the management team mm-hmm. to help them achieve their goals. We may not be involved in a simple transaction like that. We're involved merger with synergies, carve out like I was talking about, mm-hmm. or a place where they need to create value, incremental value mm-hmm. in order to win the deal, right? You have to remember a lot of these processes are competitive. They're an auction-based process. So you have multiple buyers talking to the seller mm-hmm. and those buyers are essentially putting in bids to go to the next round. And so they have to put in a competitive bid in order yeah. to do that. Sometimes they have to have a plan to create incremental value with the business. Mm-hmm. So those are the scenarios where the operational folks tend to get involved.
Okay. Now, what do you typically focus on specifically? I mean, you mentioned some of the stuff earlier on doing operational due diligence, but maybe let's talk about that a little bit more specifically.
Yeah, so when we're doing an ODD, we're really seeking to understand the operating model. So how does each business function within the organization do their work? More specifically, how will any changes in the business for that operating model impact the P&L? So at the most basic level, thinking about the operating model, it's your people, it's your processes, and it's your systems. So we'll go function by function and seek to understand what resources are supporting the IT function, what resources are supporting the finance function. Are there efficient processes in place that make sense for the organization? Or perhaps there's room to improve. What volumetrics would we use to measure the value of any possible process improvements that exist? Systems is always a big one to look at, making sure there's appropriate systems in place. Are they automated? Are they efficient? What's the cost around those?
Give me some examples of some systems.
So your basic systems are going to be things like an ERP. Often small companies are going to be running off of something like QuickBooks. If you're looking to have a platform to scale, an investment that may be required, something more appropriate for financial reporting, such as a NetSuite solution. So you would expect an incremental cost there flowing through to the P&L, for example.
So that would be an incremental cost that would outflow, but the benefit would come back to you.
Absolutely.
Down the road,
absolutely.
Right? And so you try to quantify when you're making these recommendations. You're saying if you do this, this is how we can bump up the value.
Absolutely. We seek to understand the current state and understand the details of the costs that are in the P&L, and then looking at the areas where there's an adjustment to that and quantify the value of that. So ultimately, you have a baseline cost for your operating expenditures, as well as a point of view on what the incremental costs may be.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What about on the labor, non-labor side? Can you speak a little bit to that?
Yeah, it's really how we break down an ODD is going to be by business function. So we talked a bit about that. And then for each business function, what are the labor and non-labor costs? Labor is very obvious. What are the roles supporting the organization? On the non-labor side, it's also looking at the very detailed expenses that exist for each function. We talked a little bit about IT and systems costs, but we also want to understand what third parties are providing support for the organization. What are those expenditures? Are they kind of what we would expect for that industry and that size business, for example?
Okay. So we talked about like operating models, growth plans, scalability, labor, things of that nature. I was in preparation for this podcast. I was talking to a client of mine that's been involved in a ton of transactions, and I was letting him know what we were going to be talking about, this operational due diligence stuff. And so, he brought up an interesting point that doesn't necessarily align with these kind of traditional, you know, components of a operational due diligence, but it's more cultural in nature, so more touchy-feely. And, you know, he was saying that these owners, the people that work at the company, I mean, the owners feel like they're family, you know, and so they want to be mindful of what's going to happen to them in a transaction. And so when they're talking to a potential private equity buyer, right, and we've all heard the war stories there, you know, the buy them and cut them and, you know, and they're, you know, pretty nasty, right? And so that's, a business owner doesn't really want that to happen. He brought up like how a company communicates to their employees. And, you know, he gave a funny example of, I think it was an engineering company, and it was super old school. And like they bought this company and they sent emails out like, hey, we're going to be having these, you know, all hands meetings, and nobody showed up. Turns out, if you don't post a physical thing above the water cooler in the break room, nobody knows what's going on. Like, it was such a simple example. And I'm like, okay, that's interesting. Because if you have like super old school kind of mentality, cultural, you know, and you got a bunch of, you know, high tech people on Slack and everything in between. And then he also brought up potential transactions with companies in other countries. And when he's looking for a potential acquisition and it's in certain countries, he's like, it's a no-go. I mean, it's just hard to blend a company from a, you know, kind of a socialist mentality to, you know, meritocracy type of company. So anyway, so point being is I wanted to bring up the cultural side of things. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's absolutely an important element. And Matt touched on this a little bit earlier, but part of that sale process is understanding who the buyer is and how you fit with them. If your company's going to be purchased and merged with another one, you want to understand that leadership team and see how that gels for you. I've absolutely been involved a lot on the post-acquisition side where you see those cultural issues play out, everything from, you know, in Europe, we might take August off. So that might not be the best time to start really heavily planning and implementing your integration plans, because it's going to be hard to capture everybody's bandwidth. And you want to make sure that folks can be available and you're not disrupting, you know, what's respected in that culture for time off. Mm-hmm. So I think that's kind of a top of mind culture example from my experience.
I think there's also, during the diligence process, the buyers are looking at a whole variety of different things, and they have some kind of investment thesis, right? So the scenario you're talking about where a private equity comes in and cuts the heck out of the business and it doesn't look anything like it used to be, there are buyers that do that, but that's the minority, at least that we work with. Mm-hmm. Most of the buyers we're dealing with are buying companies to grow and improve them, like in a real way. And they're usually pretty transparent about what that will be. Mm-hmm. And so as a seller, you're listening to that. That's why I was saying earlier, it's a two-way street. And you're trying to understand, is that what I want for the future of this business? Their offer, their purchase price offer may be higher, but it doesn't match your goals for the business. That's something you've got to think about and figure out as you're trying to pick who is the buyer that's going to buy my business. So the culture and the relationship between you and the private equity firm is important in every transaction. And then if it's a merger scenario, you get into the cultural issues Aaron was talking about. You know, how do the two companies actually come together? Mm-hmm. And you'll see a lot of pronounced differences internationally, you know, what are time off standards, how many hours do people work in a week, how easy it is to hire and fire people, are people on time to meetings, do meetings run long? Mm-hmm. But even in the US, you see big differences in, is it a top-down kind of leadership structure? Do they push decisions down to the grassroots of the company and let them kind of run their own function? So where decisions are made, what authorities people have, how direct you are in your communication, all those different things come into play in a merger. Mm-hmm. And they can really impact the value, the potential synergies, or the 1+1=3 part of the equation when those two companies come together. So the cultural aspect weaves into the entire process.
Right. I think another important thing for owners to consider is in the way the deal is structured, that, you know, there's the price for the company that they're going to pay, and then there's more than likely some sort of earnout component to that deal, right? And so from the owner's perspective, really clearly understanding what that earnout component is, what their reporting requirements are going to be, and how, you know, what are their KPIs and whatnot, right? And so
for sure,
if it's based on top line or bottom line, that's two very different numbers.
Yeah, and you in those scenarios as a seller, you're going to be thinking about what are they going to do to my business that impacts my ability to hit those numbers, right? So if it's a top line number and they're coming in and merging your sales force with another sales force, you may want to say, look, we're going to have to wait on that until the earnout period is done.
Yes.
Right? Because mm-hmm. you don't want that noise to be happening while you're trying to hit your numbers, right? If it's a bottom line number, you could benefit from the merger, right? Like, hey, I'm trying to hit a bottom line number. I'm going to actually be combining two accounting functions, and not to pick on CFOs, but we don't need two CFOs in the future. Yeah. So that could actually give you a benefit on the mm-hmm. on the bottom line, right? So I think you have both sides of it. You raise a good point. Earnouts are something a seller's gonna want to think through as they're going through this process.
Gotcha. Speaking from, you know, I know a lot of the work that you do, Matt, is on the buy side.
Yep.
Nico, sounds like you do maybe some more work on the sell side or helping prepare these
Correct.
Companies.
We basically cover the whole M&A cycle, but yes, we've done like sell sides and yep. buy sides like all the okay. time.
From a founder standpoint, what can they do to prepare for this process, this operational due diligence?
So we've talked a lot about really thinking what they're looking for in a partner. So I think that all echoes true here. But I think important things for what they can expect and how they should think about the process is, first of all, the time allocation. Mm-hmm. It can be a time-intensive process. And if you think about an auction process where there could potentially be multiple bidders, they're going to all be asking for data requests. So I think preparing your data in advance, making sure you have a clean set of financials that's the single source of truth with a sufficient level of detail of what's in those numbers is important. You can do that prep work in advance to have that ready. Then thinking about your time as you're going into the process, you would be fulfilling data requests. You're going to be having interviews with potential buyers and their advisors. They're each going to want to understand the business functions within the company, perhaps have follow-up meetings. So that can be 5 to 10 hours of interviews for each prospective buyer. So multiply that by however many are in the process. So there may come a point where you want to think about, you know, continuing forward with a certain number just based on the time allocation, because you also need to keep the business running. And then finally, it's when are you going to get your management team under the tent? If a founder is kind of thinking about going into this process, they're going to need to think about very likely having their financial leader under the tent, other key leadership. You know, if you're a technology business, you want your CTO available for those discussions. So being very thoughtful about how you're going to bring them into the process and prepare them. When you have these interviews during due diligence, you want to be extremely on point with your responses, and that your responses tie back to that set of financial information that's been shared. So you need to be able to really be succinct and prepare your responses in advance so that you're coming to those interviews and discussions really just ticking and tying back to the available information and making sure you're aligned with your management team.
What happens? I mean, people under the tent. I mean, you mentioned the financial and the technology people. Do you see founders incentivizing some of the people under the tent for a successful outcome? Or do you have any examples on that?
There's a lot of, I think, fear and uncertainty that comes with a transaction, right, for everybody in the business, right? Am I still going to have a job? Yeah. Is my salary going to change? Is my boss going to change? Am I going to be reporting to somebody else? Am I going to like them? You're trying to, first of all, bring the people under the tent that have the right level of maturity to handle issues like that. A lot of times in founder-led businesses, you'll find a situation where you have a really strong relationship between the CEO and the CFO. The CFO is the right-hand person of the CEO. They're used to thinking about complex issues and topics like this. A lot of times the people under the tent are executives, and they may also have equity in the business, so they have some potential upside based on a transaction as well, right? So there's some self-interest that kind of naturally aligns in situations like that. From a buyer's perspective, they're looking at, they're trying to understand the retention risks they may have with the employees as well, right? So both sides' interests kind of align in this area better than you think, right? Because they don't want to come in and buy the company. CTO gets mad and leaves, right? It's a software company. The CTO just walked out the door. That's a disaster, right? Unless, you know, you've got a different plan for the technology. But in most acquisitions, that's a disaster.
Right.
So the buyer is also wondering who's at risk and how to incentivize those people to stay. And those incentives usually happen more on the buy side than the sell side, right? You know, so the seller has already put in place a comp structure and incentive structure with his people. Sometimes that supports a transaction, but the buyer is going to want to think about that as well.
Yeah, they're going to want to see employment contracts and make sure that they're going to be sticking around.
And they want to just give people a hug, right? Yeah. They want to talk to the CTO and say, hey, look, you're part of the future here. We're investing to help you achieve your technology vision and your growth vision for this business as much as anything else. So there's a little bit of just the let's give them a warm hug and make sure they know they're part of the team to try to, we call them the what about me or wham issues, right? That's the first thing that goes through everybody's mind when they first hear about an integration. So that's why that, you know, bringing people under the tent has to be done thoughtfully.
What about me? I'm going to add that one to my list. I got a buddy one too, which is the challenge that we've had over the last year and a half in the M&A market. Not exactly a lot of transactions going on, and the value and the bid ask spread being so wide, and the offers that are coming out. You know, and the owners is like, I got a buddy that sold for twice that, you know, yeah, a year and a half ago at zero interest rate environments. And,
yeah.
It's a little M&A market. So the what about me thing, I need to add that one. So
yeah.
What risks do you typically see in operational due diligence? I mean, we just talked about kind of the key people, you know, risk, their succession.
When you step back, kind of the table stakes to me are, you know, lack of operational or financial data, right? You come into a business and they don't have any KPIs for how that business runs. It's more intuitive than it is numerical, right? So that's a big red flag. People need to understand their business and the operational and financial metrics so the private equity can get their head around how are we going to know what's going on here, right? Organizational structure issues. You'll have over-dependence on the leader, right? The leader makes every decision. The company's not scalable. You'll have crazy org structures, right? Where you've got somebody's cousin that may or may not be qualified leading a key function of the business.
And family-owned businesses, yeah, you probably get a lot of that.
Sometimes you'll run into that. Sometimes you don't, right? It's not a one-size-fits-all. Mm-hmm. But do they have the right, like a rational org structure? Does it seem efficient? Are there unnecessary handoffs? Do the processes kind of work, or does the org structure fight against the processes? You'll see broken processes where, you know, everything is done manually. It's done by hand. If the private equity is coming in looking for a growth play, mm-hmm, that scalability issue is huge. So they're going to be thinking about what major investments are needed to fix these broken processes. Aaron mentioned systems earlier, outdated systems, inefficient systems, unintegrated systems, systems that don't scale. QuickBooks is great for a certain size of business, but private equity typically want better visibility into the financials. It's not possible to do it with QuickBooks. So, you know, you're looking at those systems and are they appropriate? I think that's a cyber is always a big topic. A history of breaches or cyber issues is not going to bode well for a process. If that happens, you need to address it, you know, and bring the right parties in to make sure it's fully addressed. I'd say those are the ones that come to mind as major risks I see. There's a lot of them. There's a lot of other ones too.
Great. Gosh, there's a lot of stuff. It's overwhelming.
There's a lot to think about.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's not every transaction, right? So a simple acquisition, a lot of times the buyer is essentially investing in the management team to help them do what they want to do, right? The management team wants to grow. They need more capital to grow. They're coming in and giving growth equity to help that business grow. It's not always we're going to create Frankenstein's monster here. We're going to, you know, cut that or merge that or do that. Mm-hmm. It's usually a well-discussed and well-known, this is what the private equity is thinking they want to do with the business. It may not come out in the first meeting, but it'll come out during that process.
Right. How much time does it typically take to do this?
It varies with the scope. So it can range from like 3 weeks to 5 weeks, depending on the complexity, the industry, what really the buyer and the seller wants to achieve. So in the low end, it might be just kicking the tires, as we mentioned, and you can take like 2 to 3 weeks to review and validate the costs that the seller is putting in front of you. Makes sense. Or it can go up to like 5 to 6 weeks where you are doing like a performance improvement and you will need like a very deep access to management to basically try to find the value you're looking to find.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've covered a lot in a very short period of time. What's your advice to founders out there that are starting to think about entertaining some of the offers that they've been getting called on by PE or some strategics? How much time in advance going through a process do you suggest, you know, starting to look at this? Is this something that you think, Nico, from your point of view, is this something that a company could benefit from doing periodically, whether they're going to go through a process or not?
I think it would depend on your financial healthiness. Mm-hmm. If you really need to stay close to your numbers and assess what's my timing to exit this business and am I in a good position to exit, market conditions, where you are with them, your growth, and who is basically your market. It's your industry really active in M&A, and how much time do you need to get from like your current point to your exit position?
So the time in advance of going through a process,
it's usually months, not weeks. You're usually starting months in advance. Uh-huh. There could be simpler scenarios where things move a lot faster, but you're usually starting months before, and you're usually starting by engaging a banker. Sometimes you may already know who you want to sell to, and there can be proprietary deals that happen. Or sometimes a buyer comes in, like you'd mentioned, and gives you unsolicited interest, like, hey, we're in the same industry, we want to buy you because it makes strategic sense. Mm-hmm. So things can come up more quickly. To me, for a seller, I think they need to know what they're trying to do with themselves in the business, right? Are they selling because they're looking to retire and take a step back? And if so, you know, how does that affect the process, mm-hmm. right? In that case, the buyers are going to want to know who's going to be leading this business going forward. Do I have to find a new CEO or, you know, so I think the sellers really need to understand what they're trying to accomplish, what their goals are. If they want to be involved with the company, are they willing to split it up and to sell off pieces? You know, think about what their non-negotiables are. I think most importantly, know what they want the private equity to give to them, right? Because it's not just selling all or part of the equity. There's a management fee that the private equity gets after ownership. What are you getting for that management fee? Are they going to actually help you grow the business by bringing resources you didn't have to play to bear? Mm-hmm. Could be capital, but it could be relationships. It could be another portfolio company. It could be all kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of times private equity firms have procurement contracts that help you buy the stuff you're already using at lower prices, right? What are they going to actually bring to the table that mm-hmm. benefits you as a seller, and looking at what is it going to be like for that relationship? Are they going to be easy to work with? Are they going to be collaborative? Are they going to be top down and come in and tell me what to do?
You said something that which sparked a thought, which is, you know, typically in our industry, a lot of people use the term exit planning, which I'm mm-hmm. not a big fan of, because I think, you know, a lot of the, especially the entrepreneur-led companies, they don't see themselves having a full exit. It's like, you know, they want to continue. They have a dream. They have a bigger goal that they want to hit at some point down the road. But at some point, they're going to want to take some chips off the table, right? And so what we're seeing, especially over the past 3 to 5 years or so, fewer like full exits.
Yes.
But mostly it's selling 20% of the company, 30% of the company, taking some chips off the table, getting a big institutional partner, you know, to sit on the same side of the table with you that can help connect you to the right resources and take you to a much bigger level, right? So just from your own experience, you know, how often do you see a full exit, it's a sell and go away kind of situation?
I think in founder-owned businesses, it's more often on the side you're talking about. The founder still wants to be involved, mm-hmm. and it's a scenario where they're either taking chips off the table or they're trying to do something that they need additional capital or resources to do, mm-hmm. right? It could be a management buyout. It could be, there's all kinds of other scenarios where somebody's trying to divest a business unit and the management team gets a private equity to give them capital to buy the company so that management team can, there's all kinds of scenarios that you'll encounter, but founder-led businesses are usually just bringing in additional capital for growth. Mm-hmm. And the private equity is buying the business essentially because they believe in the founder and what that founder is trying to do.
Right. So something that we bring up to people as well as is not being the company, not being too owner dependent. But as I think about it, if it's not a sell and go away kind of thing, I mean, if it was a sell and go away kind of thing, that's extremely important, you know, that you need to create a company that's transferable.
Yeah.
Without you.
Yeah. Right? We call that key person risk, right?
Yeah.
You're looking at it across the business. Mm-hmm. So if it's a software company, I keep using software company examples because I work a lot in software. Mm-hmm. If the CTO is the only one that knows what's going on with the technology and the code, that's a form of key person risk, whether they're a founder or not, yep. Right? And what risk is an investor taking that's tied up in an individual? You can take the positive, what if they win the lottery? You can take the negative, what if they're hit by a bus? Mm-hmm. Either way, if they're out of the business, what is the risk? So yeah. It's not just the founder that happens. But I think you're looking for a professional, like a professionally run organization that's appropriate for the size of that business. Mm-hmm. So in smaller businesses, it's not uncommon for the founder to make all decisions and really run every function. Mm-hmm. And they've got kind of mid-level managers helping them achieve scale. When you get to a certain size, you're expecting to have a CFO in the business, not just
what
a
size would you say that would be? Generally,
it's difficult for me to say. I don't know
if you guys have. Software would be different.
I think when you cross the $10 million revenue, you start seeing a much more professional team under the CEO.
Okay.
Before that, I mean, under 10, I think you can still manage your AP and your AR as the CEO. But after that, it's just too much of a volume. I mean, if you ask me what's the advice for a seller, I would say don't never underestimate the challenge and the complexity of an M&A process. And after completing the transaction, you have the post integration.
Work's not done.
Yes.
Work's
are you going to continue? Yes. Are you going to continue being the CEO or you're going to be the CPO now, given to Matt's point? You are basically the person that owns and knows the product, yeah. But there is another CEO with 35 years of experience and you have 10.
Yeah.
Those things are really challenging, and those are part of like assessing during the operational due diligence. Mm-hmm. What's the culture? What's the strategy? What's for me after we have completed this transaction mm-hmm. as an owner?
Yep. So you got to make sure they've got enough gas in the tank. They can't go into this process with a quarter tank.
Yeah.
I or think be that's upfront true. From the beginning.
Yeah. 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 Let's wrap it up. Any parting thoughts? Nico, advice?
I think that's my main point. Don't ever underestimate the complexity of the transaction and bear in mind that there is more story to be written after you have completed the acquisition or the divestiture. You may want to stay or you may be invited to stay so you can make your run out after the process.
Okay. Aaron?
Yeah, I think just trust your management team. Start thinking about that future mindset early and what your vision is for the future, and recognizing that that's going to mean empowering those leaders to step up and own their functions. I think the earlier a founder can do that, they're setting themselves up to avoid some of the issues we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, I think it's really important to go in with a positive mindset, right? You know, most private equity firms are really there to help you grow and improve the business, right? You're both incented by the same thing at the end of the day. As long as you find one where your thesis is aligned with their thesis, it can be a great thing. And you see private equity investments take a company to a new level.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the private equity principles, they're being judged by the investors in the private equity fund, right? And so they have to deliver returns. In order to do that, you got to buy good companies and help them grow. And if you see that potential, so oftentimes, sometimes it feels like, you know, that when sellers and buyers are at the negotiating table, it can feel a little adversarial. But in reality, you're dating and trying to figure out, because I mean, this is a marriage here, you know, yeah. And it's going to last for a long time and hopefully be productive and.
I think that's a good way to think about it.
Fruitful, yeah. So, okay, well, good. Well, Matt, Nico, Aaron, thank you so much for coming down here and doing this live. It's fun to do these things live. So
yeah, we walked all the way across the street to visit you.
So. Well, great.
It's our pleasure.
For those of you out there, our listeners, thank you for staying tuned here and learning about operational due diligence. I know it's not exactly the most exciting thing, but it's an incredibly important component of the process of the life cycle of building, owning, growing, and eventually exiting a business. And so we thank everybody, we thank our guests here for joining us, and thank you for listening. And with that, we'll let you go. Be safe, be well. And until next time, we'll talk soon. On behalf of our entire team here at ATX Wealth Partners, we hope you enjoyed this program. And if you have any questions or comments, feel free to email us at atxwealthpartners@ubs.com. And remember this, know your options, be informed, and plan early. Until next time, take care and be well.
This podcast is presented for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as investment advice or the basis for making any investment decisions. It does not constitute an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any specific product or service. UBS does not provide legal or tax advice, and we would recommend listeners to obtain appropriate independent professional advice. Some of the views and opinions expressed may not be those of UBS Group AG or its affiliates. UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. These services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreements and disclosures that we provide about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary. UBS Financial Services, Inc. is a subsidiary of UBS Group AG and is a member of FINRA and SIPC.